We're now going to begin our discussion of Ashkenazic Jewry in the Middle Ages, in the medieval, the period of medieval Jewish history. How did Jews get to Ashkenaz? We begin our discussion in Rome. Jews are living in Rome around the time of the destruction of the Second Beis Hamikdash. Second Beis Hamikdash was destroyed around 70 of the Common Era. Now, in the course of time, Rome conquered Gaul, which is now called France and Western Germany. And soon thereafter, cities sprang up. And some Jews moved there from Rome, and they were mostly peddlers. It seems that the first Jewish settlers in France and Germany may have been between the first and third centuries. And eventually the Roman Empire is falling apart. And at the end of the fifth century, local tribes begin to assert their independence. One of these tribes was the Franks, who lived in the northern area of Gaul. And the leader of the Franks, Clovis, established a kingdom called the Frankish Kingdom. This was a Christian kingdom. In the year 732, the Muslims were halted in their conquest of the world in the Frankish Kingdom by a Christian army led by the Frankish warrior Charles Martel. The most famous Frankish ruler of the 8th century was Charlemagne, whose rule lasted from 768 to 814 of the Common Era, and he expanded the borders of the Frankish kingdom. In the year 800, he becomes the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and there was an alliance between the church and Charlemagne. Now, generally speaking, if you're a Jew who's living in the Middle Ages, you want the non-Jewish ruler to care a lot about money and to not be so religious. The more that the non-Jewish leader cared about money, he wanted Jews living in his territory, and he was nice to them. And the more religious he was, the more intolerant he was of Jews. So therefore, you wanted your non-Jewish ruler to be not so religious and to care a lot about money. Now, Charlemagne, despite being very religious, was very good to the Jews. He was a strong secular leader, means that there was weak clerical influence, and he found it in his interest to protect the Jews and their expanding commerce. His son, Louis the Pious, who ruled from 814 to 840, was even more favorable to the Jews, and Jews were so important economically during this period that the market day of Lyon was changed from Saturday to a weekday. And it was in this favorable climate many Jews moved to France and Germany. Now, during this time, the Jews who were once farmers, say from the year 350 to 650, became merchants. You know, and if you read the Mishnah and the Gemara, it seems most of the Jews were farmers or landowners, but eventually they became merchants. And the question is why? So first of all, Christian slave owning was prohibited. Jews were not allowed to hold on to a slave for more than 3 months. There was a fear of conversion, that the Jews would convert these slaves. So if you don't have slaves, then you're typically, it's going to be hard for you to own land, because typically landowners use slaves to work on their land. And if you weren't allowed to own slaves, it wasn't financially worthwhile to own land. So that's the first reason why Jews started they stopped becoming landowners. And number two, the second reason is because of feudalism. The feudalism was a political and economic system which involved joining a military defense association. And this association essentially stated that a landowner could be called upon to help another landowner defend himself and his lands from bands of thieves and land-greedy neighbors. These associations demanded a religious oath, which Jews could not make the oath. And the land-owning nobles used religion thereby to squeeze the Jews out of the land-owning class, because most Jews did not convert and were not willing to issue a religious oath. And so Jews left the land-owning business, they left the farming business, and they became merchants. And there was a major advantage for Jews to become merchants. The Jews as merchants were called Radhanites, Radhanites. And in the 9th century, a document from the 9th century said the following about the Jews who were the merchants, the Radhanites. It says they speak Arabic, Persian, Greek, Frankish, Andalusian, and Slavonic. They travel from east to west and from west to east by both land and sea. From the west, they bring adult slaves, girls and boys, beaver pelts, assorted furs, sables, and swords. They sail from the land of the Franks on the western sea, which is the Mediterranean, and set out for Al-Faram, which is the easternmost city in Lower Egypt. There they transport their merchandise by pack animal to Al-Kulzum, which is 25 parsings away. At Al-Kulzum, they set sail for Al-Jar and Jidda, after which they proceed to Sindh, India, and China. From China, they bring musk, aloes wood, camphor, cinnamon, and other products obtained from those regions as they make their way back to Al-Kulzum. So in other words, they're traveling all the way from the west, from France, from Germany, all the way to as far east as India and China. They would export furs and weapons to the east and tapestries, cloth, silk, and sugar and spice to Western Europe. They were important in commerce because they were multilingual, knowing Hebrew, Arabic, Persian, Greek, and other languages. But the major advantage of the Jew is that at a time when Christians quarreled with Muslims, the Jews were not involved in any quarrels, and therefore they were trusted by Christian and Muslim alike. So they were permitted to travel freely in their lands. And this provided an excellent opportunity for the Jews to trade. And Jews ended up creating trading stations with other Jews throughout the world to enable trade lines from France all the way to India and China. Now, it should be noted, as I mentioned, that the Radonites traded slaves. During the Middle Ages, slave trade was viewed as legitimate and was perceived as necessary. For example, as the inhabitants of Western Europe pushed their way deeper into Central Europe, driving the Slavic inhabitants farther east, they brought back captives whom they sold to Jewish traders. The church, as I mentioned, objected to Jews retaining the slaves for themselves, but they had no objection to slavery or to the slave trade. During the 10th and 11th centuries, the importance of Jews as international merchants and gradually as local merchants continued to be appreciated. At this time, a Jewish community meant a prosperous town. There is a document from 1084, which is only 12 years before the First Crusade, and it's from the Bishop of Speyer. And the document is called Grant of Lands and Privileges to the Jews. It's a document from someone named Rudiger, who is the bishop. And essentially, the document says that, Rudiger writes, "I thought I would increase the honor I was bestowing on the place if I brought in the Jews. Therefore, I placed them outside the town and some way off from the houses of the rest of the citizens. Unless they should be too easily disturbed by the insolence of the citizens, I surrounded them with a wall." So he writes that he encouraged Jews to move to Speyer, and they would pay him a tax, and he would give them a place to live outside the town and protect them with the use of a wall. And in this document, he gives them the full power to change gold and silver, to buy and sell what they please. He also gives them a land for a cemetery with rights of inheritance. He also gives them right to judge themselves. As long as the Jews pay taxes, then they can judge themselves according to their own laws. And the Christian inhabitants of the towns were very friendly. The only difference between them was religion, but the Jews dressed and acted like their Christian neighbors and spoke the same language. For Jews in Ashkenaz, life was pretty good until the First Crusade, 1096. That's when the situation radically changed. Now, what was the community like for Ashkenazic Jews? So it's not clear what the population was exactly. There was a traveler named Benjamin of Tudela. He was a Spanish traveler. And he writes, at the end of the 12th century, there are 6,000 Jews in 6 major communities in France. Other historians write that by approximately 1096, just before the First Crusade, there are probably about 20,000 Jews in Germany, compared to about 55,000 Jews, or maybe double that in Muslim Spain in 1050. It's hard to know exact figures. I found one source that said at one point in the Golden Age of Spain, there might have been 90% of Jews were in Muslim Spain at the beginning of the 12th century. An important city in Ashkenaz might have 40 to 50 Jewish families among a few thousand Christian families. Jews lived among the Christians and vice versa. Now, all Jews belong to the Jewish community. And if a Jew refused to accept the regulations imposed by the Jewish community, including Jewish religious observances, he could be punished. Jews had the right to imprison a fellow Jew, punish him with lashes, or by excommunication. This last punishment was the severest penalty, for it meant that no Jew, not even a member of his immediate family, would have anything to do with the excommunicated man or woman. If this excommunicated Jew moved to another town, the Jews there would usually also exclude him as soon as they found out about his past. There was nothing left for him to do other than to become a Christian. In such an event, however, the Christian government, for reasons of its own, cooperated with the Jews by confiscating the man's property. One who was excommunicated could not be counted for a minyan. His male children would be denied circumcision. He would be denied burial in a Jewish cemetery, and business dealings with him were forbidden. Excommunication was thus a very powerful weapon in the hands of the community leaders and enabled them to enforce their authority. What was rabbinic leadership like in the early medieval period in Ashkenaz? So as I mentioned, Jews were living in Rome around the time of the destruction of the Second Beis HaMikdash. Jews in Italy generally were in touch with the Jews of Eretz Yisrael for guidance, unlike the rest of the diaspora who were more in touch with Bavel and followed the Talmud Bavli. While many scholars came to Spain, Egypt, and North Africa, as I discussed in a previous lecture in the 10th century, even earlier, several scholars had come to live in southern France called Provence. Additionally, Rav Moshe of Lucca and his son Colonimus moved from Italy to Mainz. The Colonimus family helped establish a yeshiva in Rome in the 8th and 9th centuries. It's not exactly clear when the Colonimus family moved to Mainz. There is a date, it's found in the Marshal, Simon Choftes, which mentions them moving, the family moving, Bishnas Tuf Memtes L'Churban HaBayis, 849 years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, which many believe was in the year 68 of the Common Era, so that would date Rav Moshe moving in the year 917. There's a mention in this tshuva how a king named HaMelech Karla brought him to Ashkenaz, and there are different opinions among historians to when the Colonimus family came to town. Some say he came that the Colonimus family came sort of the end of the 9th century, and maybe it wasn't Tuf Tef Mem Tes. You missed the letter Mem. It was really Tuf Tef Tes. So some want to say that's 876 because they talked about a King Karla, which may refer to King Charles the Bald. There's another theory that the Colonimus family moved in around 982 or 983. A famous historian of this time period, Professor Grossman, believes that really he argues that if the tshuva gives a specific date of Tuf Mem Tes, that is probably very precise, which means they probably came around the year 917. But he thinks that when the tshuva writes that there was this Melech Karla who brought them over, it was just to give chashivus to Germany. It was just to tell them, oh, Charlemagne, who's Karla, brought them over, because the golden age of Germany is associated with Charlemagne. So, and he says they may that this rabbinic family may have not even been brought over by a specific king, but just maybe a legend written a few hundred years after the fact associates him or associates Charlemagne with bringing over this Jewish family. You can simply argue that maybe these families moved over based on economic concerns. But in any case, what seems clear, there's a radical change in Jewish life and minds with the coming of Rav Moshe and his son Rav Colonimus from Italy, maybe in 917, according to Professor Grossman, and to add significance to it, a story was created. And that seems to be what he thinks. What's significant also about this family, the Colonimus family, is that it was a mystical community. The Rokeach, who was a mystic in Ashkenaz, and he, in his commentary on the Siddur, he writes that he learned the secrets to the prayers, to the tefillot. There's the mystical secrets to the tefillot from a group of people, and some of these people were family members of the Colonimus family. And this is this family probably was among the origins or the forerunners to what later became known as the Hasidei Ashkenaz, the mystics of Ashkenaz. And what this demonstrates in this commentary by the Rokeach is that this family, the Colonimus family, this rabbinic family, cared not only about Torah's Hanigla, about the revealed Torah, but also Torah's Hanistar, mystical Torah. That's why you don't have this type of rabbinic family moving to, for the most part, to the Spanish, to the Sephardi communities under Muslim rule. That's why the rabbinic leaders in Muslim Spain, for the most part, discussed and halacha, Tanakh, a little bit of commentary, philosophy, grammar, poetry, but no mysticism. But in Ashkenaz, there's a strong, especially in Germany, there's a strong mystical tradition, and much of that may have come from this great early rabbinic family that came to Ashkenaz, the Colonimus family.